Welcome to the House of Strauss.
Yeah, go for it.
Stars hang with stars, winners hang with winners.
Si un jour tu m'emmènes à la plage, j'aimerais t'en plonger dans les vagues. Je te promets que je resterai sage, mais tu ne comprends pas que je rêve de ça.
It is House of Strauss. We are joined by Joe Pompliano. I hope you don't get offended by me making that all Italian as I said it. How you doing, Joe?
I'm doing fantastic, Ethan. How are you?
I am doing quite well. This should have happened sooner. We have so many overlapping topics of interest. Obviously, you've got the Big Time newsletter. You've got the Joe Pomp Show. You talk so much about sports and business, and we've got a good occasion to speak with you because sports gambling having a bit of a moment. I would not have expected this tweet of yours to have gone viral, but it certainly has. Let's open up with that. You tweeted about a new policy that the NBA is having on League Pass. You have many incisive tweets. You have many compelling threads. I would not have expected this particular tweet to go viral. Can you describe what it was? And maybe we can try to analyze why it popped in such a way and resonated.
It's funny you say that because, you know, when you send out tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of tweets, you get a pretty good gauge of what's going to be popular and what's not. And this was one that I certainly didn't expect to be popular, but I think it really struck a lot of people in frustrations that they've had. And for people that don't know, the tweet was just the announcement that the NBA is adding in-game betting to NBA League Pass. So to their credit, whatever you want to call it, you can opt out of it. So it's not for everyone if you don't want it there. But if you go into the app now, you'll be able to see live betting lines while you're watching a game, pick the bet that you want to place, and then it'll take you directly to DraftKings or FanDuel to place that bet. And I simply just said, hey, look, this is kind of a natural extension, and it feels like other leagues are going to do this eventually. But a lot of people got upset, and I think rightfully so, because like, who asked for that, right? I don't know anyone that was really asking for it.
My grandma, yeah. She asked for it. She was, if only I could have a way to bet the games live action. That's not how my grandmother's deceased. That's not what she sounds like. She sounded like an old Jewish woman. Anyway, continue. You were saying.
No, well, and there's a million other things that people want improved with League Pass, right? And I think it just speaks to how deep these relationships are getting between the leagues, the teams, and the betting companies. And look, we can go on the path of whether sports betting should be legalized or not. I've always said that I think legalization is fine. I've worked with sports betting partners in the past. I've invested in some of these companies, and I largely don't have a problem with sports betting. What I have a problem with in most cases is how aggressive some of this stuff has been marketed to sports fans. And I would say a younger generation of sports fans who grew up with smartphones, have a dopamine addiction and other things like that too. And that's really where the problem lies, not necessarily the technology or other things like that. It's how aggressive this marketing campaign has gotten over the last several years.
Yeah. So there's so much there. I know Haralabob Vulgaris, the famous NBA gambler turned soccer team owner. I'm not sure if he's semi-retired from the betting or whatnot. Here's what's interesting to me, Joe, is that it's not just him. I know sharps, I know professional gamblers who are especially worried and are conveying this concern for society and the younger generation. People can analyze whatever their motivations might be, but that is curious and I think rather alarming. Now, one thing that he says and one thing that you said is that in Europe, there is more regulation and they had a gambling boom that is now aggressively being rolled back as America is getting so expansive and glibly just jumping in with both feet. Can you elaborate on that and describe what's happening in Europe versus what's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, you pretty much explained it without getting too far into it. They saw a boom in sports betting. It became huge there, and it became a huge problem because of that, right? People were gambling. They were losing their life savings. There was people committing suicide. Like, it just became this huge mess because it was being promoted everywhere, like you're seeing here today. And what's happened over the last few years is, like take the Premier League, for example. They recently announced maybe a year or two ago that they were going to start banning gambling sponsorships on the front of team shirts. So you could no longer promote gambling on the front of your shirt. Now, you could have a sign in the stadium. I think you could even put it on the side of the shirt. But essentially, the idea was that they didn't want it on the front of the shirt anymore, which is obviously the most lucrative advertising area. And this wasn't like one or two teams. I think it was more than half the Premier League had gambling sponsors that were on the front of their jersey. So it was a major revenue source that they're going to end up taking away. But the idea that I was tweeting out was that in Europe, who has already seen this play out because they did it several decades before us, is now going the opposite because it became such a mess. Where in America, we had the opportunity to learn from what they've done, and we're still doing it. We're even doing it more aggressively than Europe probably did it.
Yeah, with technology that I think just overwhelms the senses. What do you make of the concerns people have that this is going to fundamentally alter in a negative way young people's connection to sport? I think it's a really hard thing to predict, but this is something that people, I think it's well-founded. I think that's certainly a concern. That's certainly the vulgaris theory that, you know, these young people right now, this is going to be their association with the sport at a young age. They're going to crap out. They're not going to be able to engage with the sport in the way that we engaged with sports growing up and watching them. It's going to be ruined for them. What's your thought on that?
Well, so I actually think the most interesting part about this is, and I agree with Bob to some degree and maybe not on other things, but the part that I think is so interesting is that the teams in the leagues almost think about it in a completely opposite way than many other people think about it, right? If I was the teams in the leagues, and I do know that they're thinking about it in this way, is that not only is it a net new revenue source. So if you're losing money in other areas that maybe aren't as lucrative in the past, like media rights, potentially going into the future, this is net new revenue, right? So it's a category that previously didn't exist from a sponsorship perspective. That's great. That's good. But a lot of them also think that it could potentially hold up media rights for a longer period of time because people are watching the games because they're betting on the games. Now, that would be a positive for them because if they're able to get more media dollars because people are watching the game because of sports betting, that's great in their opinion. The problem is that I agree with Bob in an instance where it could have a fundamental impact on how many people end up watching games long term, right? Today, it's great because people are watching the games because they're betting on the games. Yeah. But if FanDuel, DraftKings, or any other sports betting operator takes all your money and you have to quit betting, you're not going to watch sports because you were betting on sports, right? What does an alcoholic do? They don't go to the bar, right? It's a fundamental difference between what you're willing to watch if you can't bet on that sport.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that, although it's hard to predict how people are going to relate to sports. I think that this does overlap with something that's discussed occasionally, and it's this looming, scary existential threat for those in charge of leagues that think far ahead, which is that when you see in surveys, Generation Alpha, the current cohort of teens, I've seen surveys where only 15%, not 50, 15, say they enjoy watching sports on television. Theoretically, under those circumstances, we should reach some kind of demographic cliff where sports viewership completely falls off. And the encouragement towards sports gambling, I do think in a way, maybe it would be happening regardless because greed is greed, but it does seem like there's a bit of desperation and willingness to compensate for something falling away. And this is some sort of spackle that they're trying to get because they've got this concern going forward that young people just don't like sports. It just seems like a circumstance where the juice might not be worth the squeeze. And just saying that is divorced from the moral implications, which are considerable.
Well, I agree with that. And I would say that all you really have to do is think about how you consume sports and why you fell in love with sports to begin with, right? And for me, I played sports growing up, right? I played basketball, football, and baseball. So basically year round, I was playing some level of sport. And then I would come home, I would watch a Giants game with my dad because he grew up in New Jersey. We'd watch a Yankees game or a Knicks game. I didn't have a cell phone when I was in middle school. And I fell in love with sports. I would watch SportsCenter every day, right? And that's obviously changed. Now middle schoolers have cell phones. They're on TikTok or Instagram. So the fundamental kind of love for sports and the connection of sports has changed. And maybe sports betting has an impact on that. But the larger problem here, I think, is that, again, I'm not against sports betting. I think that by and large, people should have the option to do what they want to do. And secondly, I think that it's probably a safer option to funnel them into regulated entities rather than having them do it through illegal bookmakers. But the problem is, and I'm sure you've seen this over the last few years, these guys stop at nothing, right? Like think about parlays, for example. When sports betting started in the US, the average hold percentage was like 5, 6, 7% max. Now these sports books are pushing over 10% hold, which is essentially just the money they get to keep after all the bets are paid out. And the reason they're able to do that is because the mix of bets has changed dramatically over the last few years. So all you have to do is you can go on any of their websites, go to a podcast that you listen to, go to someone's Twitter feed, and everyone that they're paying to promote these businesses and these bets are really, in most cases, doing parlays or same game parlays now. And the reason they do that, again, is because the hold on a parlay can get up to 20 to 25% on average versus the hold on a regular bet, which might be 5 or 6%. And that's dramatically changed the relationship between people winning money and losing money as well. And you know this. If you win money, the end result is only one thing. It's that you can't bet anymore on sports because any of these operators will kick you out of their book and you won't be able to bet anymore.
Yeah, and we'll get to that part of it. I want to address that part of it. I find that part to be so underrated and a worthy discussion point. But to address what you're saying, I'm trying to remember what the terminology is for why the parlay is so devastating and so great for the book. Is it conjoined outcomes, something like that, with probabilities? It's a hole in human psychology. There's just something about our psychology where making a guy making two free throws in a row, if he's a 60% free throw shooter, doesn't feel as unlikely as it actually is when you actually, you know, multiply 60% times 60%. There's a hole in human psychology where we think that we're going to win the parlay and we have a much better chance of winning the parlay than we actually do, which is why they are so aggressively trying to funnel us towards the parlay. Now, this gets to something right here that I think people don't totally get about sports betting. I think a lot of people who are not sharps have this assumption. It's a healthy assumption. It's a self-protective assumption that it's just impossible to properly gamble on sports. That's not true. That's actually not true. If you're smart and if you're observant, you can beat the books. You can do it. I've tried it. I can speak to this because I actually put myself out in the open in 2019 for The Athletic. And I said, look, I'm going to pick NBA games and it's going to be in front of God and everybody. You guys can all laugh at me. But no, I beat the books. Now, here's the problem. It's not that I'm any kind of genius. I just watched a ton of basketball. I watched a ton of basketball and I tried to find the market inefficiency with every game. And so if you put in the time and the energy, you can actually beat the books. Now, before somebody hearing that, I don't know, runs to their phone or, you know, drives to Tahoe to start placing some bets, the issue, as Joe is indicating, is that they don't let you win. That's the issue. You don't have to win a lot to be algorithmically locked out of these apps. You don't. And you don't have to win a lot to be effectively locked out physically from these sports books. And this is something that I think is rarely said, and it just offends me at some kind of level that you are not allowed to win. And this is a topic where there's a lot of debate, a lot of discussion. I was disagreeing a little bit with Bob. We were kind of going back and forth a little bit in a cordial way where I said, hey, I would be in favor of some sort of legislation where they've got to take your action individually. He was stressing that that's not really what he's about. I think he's more in the regulation. And he thinks that they're going to try to find even more problem gamblers. My position, Joe, they're trying to find as many goddamn problem gamblers as they can find regardless. If this is something that's metastasized to such a degree, I want to cut their margins. And if there's some sort of rule where they've got to take $100,000 of action per individual bettor, I mean, I don't know. People can debate the specifics of what the rule should be. I'm in favor of it because at some level, there's something ugly to me about this circumstance where the second that you have the edge on them, they say, you can't bet with us anymore. I don't like it. I'm not in favor of it. What say you?
So I agree. I don't know if it's, you know, regulation or what it entails, but anyone that has ever won at a sports book knows that if you win any incremental amount, that you will be limited to $5 to $10 bets, which is obviously not right because essentially what they're doing is they're guaranteeing that they win in the end because they're only going to allow losers into their book. So I wholeheartedly don't agree with that. The thing that I think frustrates me sometimes too is like I always thought of sports betting as a low, like kind of a low cost way of entertainment, right? If it was me, maybe you're betting $10, $50, max $100 on a game. And it's a few hours long. You get to talk to your buddies about it. And it's like this low cost form of entertainment. But over the years, it's completely changed and people are betting on every, I can't have a conversation with people. I can't listen to a podcast. I can't go to an arena without getting hit in some way with sports gambling advertisements. So I think it's more of a regulation around kind of like how they're able to advertise, how they're able to promote, who they're allowed to, you know, cut out of the books and things like that. But another thing that I think doesn't get talked about enough, and I'd be curious your opinion on, is just like what's been happening in the world over the last few years. And how that's played a role, right? So if you think about housing prices, for example, I know a lot of people feel like they'll never be able to afford a house because you have this, you know, this issue where housing prices have obviously gone up tremendously over the last decade, but a lot of older people aren't willing to move now because their interest rates were locked in at such a low rate that has obviously escalated. And like that kind of feels helpless, right? And I think that's why we've seen, you know, certain crypto assets appreciate in value over the last few years. There's meme coins. You had the whole thing with AMC. And I think it all kind of fits together and gambling is a piece of that because in some sense, people feel helpless and they're trying to, like you said, you see online DraftKings, FanDuel, whoever's promoting, hey, this guy turned $10 into $500,000 through a parlay. There's a reason why that's getting promoted so much, right? There's a reason why they're tweeting about it. There's a reason why they're paying influencers or other people to talk about it online. And it's because that's the best customer they could ever imagine. Someone that just keeps coming and keeps coming and keeps coming and betting $10, $20 at a time on these outrageously long parlays.
Yeah, I haven't really connected it to what's going on in the world more generally. I think there's something interesting. I mean, there are so many things to connect that to. One is just, what is it going to be for young men in general? Because it seems like young men are so much more predisposed to this than women are. I mean, not every gender gap is bad for women. I don't think that we need to encourage women to get on the sports gambling level of men. I think it works out for them quite nicely that they aren't. Is this going to have an impact in aggregate? I don't know. I hadn't thought to really connect it to everything else going on in the world and that general feeling of helplessness. You're going to say?
Yeah. So one of the things that I don't think is necessarily helpful, right, is just complaining about it, which I've done enough and I continue to do because I don't think some things are necessarily correct or right. But I guess the real question is like, what is the solution? Like, where do we go from here? Have you heard anything that's like a viable thing that we can do in the future to either limit this or kind of put people in the right direction?
Well, this is why it's interesting to have this conversation with you because you are pro legalization. And I don't know. There are some topics where I don't recall having a position on them until it was decided, right? I don't have a position on what every law and rule should be. But I think if you came to me before all this happened, I could easily see myself being in favor of the mass legalization that has occurred. And now I am increasingly open to just going back to what it was before. And because my political ideology that I've tried to coin and popularize is just how did that work outism, where, yes, there's some consideration of, you know, rights and liberties and everything else. And these things are tricky because like you, I like the idea of adults being able to do what they want to do. But if the outcome is bad enough, If it is significantly bad enough, as I get older, I'm increasingly open to the argument that maybe not for this, right? Where I go, hey, when I was younger, for instance, drug legalization, I would have been down with legalizing all the drugs. And I could clearly see that there are these bad outcomes connected to having these black markets, as opposed to, as you say, legal, regulated, whatever, whatever. Now I look and I go, man, I don't know. I don't know if fentanyl, I don't know if meth, I don't know if the human brain can really handle these things. And so this just might have to be something that is made moderately illegal. And I'm feeling that way with gambling where I go, was it really so bad that we had this place called Las Vegas that we could visit and then we could return from, and this could be a place to kind of cathartically get our rocks off with this without Las Vegas being everywhere. I want to visit Las Vegas, Joe. I don't want to live in Las Vegas. And right now, it feels like I'm living in Las Vegas. So I'm open to returning to the illegality, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And I think the argument there, right, is that I don't know what percentage, but a large percentage of people that are betting on sports today would have never went and found an illegal bookie, yeah. even though you can. It's not people talk about illegal. Yeah. People talk about bookies like it's like the most secret thing in the world. There's bookies literally everywhere in LA and other places too. So like the Ohtani news wasn't necessarily surprising because if you're in LA, you want to bet on sports, you can bet on sports. But I just think that it's like this thing that you have to go out and find. It feels a little bit shady.
Exactly.
It's obviously against the law.
I'll just jump in. I think legality is a strong signal to the normie. I really think it is, as to, because there is this argument that, oh, people would find a way to do blank. You know, this is something that cuts across political ideologies. Everybody, I feel like, has some sort of, if you look at whatever political ideology, everybody has some sort of lie they tell themselves about how prohibition doesn't work. Prohibition works, strictly speaking, to in some measure prohibit the thing it is designed to prohibit. There are externalities that might come from that. I mean, I've talked about this on this podcast where literal prohibition reduced alcohol consumption. Was it worth overstepping or stepping on people's civil liberties? Was it worth saying you're not allowed to drink alcohol if you want to drink alcohol? I think at some level, no. And that's even before we get into the whole the gangs and the organized crime that were connected to it all. You know, that's a different conversation. But strictly speaking, it did prohibit alcohol in some measure. I think this is true for everything. And you find some of these issues where the conservatives don't want to admit it, and you find some of these issues where the liberals don't want to admit it. In some measure, the more legal you make guns, the easier it is for people to get guns. I mean, that's just, I think, very, very obvious. And then on the other side, I think a lot of progressives don't want to admit aforementioned the drugs. The easier you make it legally to get drugs, the more people will get drugs. I mean, this is the case. And sports gambling seems to be one of these things, to what you're saying. And it's oddly one of these things where neither side of the political aisle really has a stake in it. I apologize for digressing, but I just wanted to get that.
No, that's exactly what I was
making a good point.
That's what I was going to say, though, was that it almost feels like everyone's somewhere in the middle, right? Like, obviously, if you talk to someone who works at a sportsbook operator, they want legalization. If you talk to someone else who doesn't sports bet and is tired of seeing it, they're against it. But it feels like the majority of people are somewhere in the middle. And I think that's the most interesting part, because you can point to issues on both sides. Obviously, on the negative side, it's what we've seen happen over the last, I mean, the content is everywhere now. It's fundamentally altered, I would argue, the way that people consume sports. Both the content side, but also in game and interacting with their athletes. And then the other side, you look at the pro side and you're like, well, why is the lottery legal? Right? Like that feels very similar. And there's a bunch of negatives that may be, you know, state funded or federally funded that give you a pause and say, okay, maybe that, you know, shouldn't be legal either. So there, you know, I see both sides of the argument, and it feels like a weird spot to sit on such an important issue. But I think that's why I've always kind of just said, hey, let's legalize it, but do it in a way where maybe it isn't as aggressive as we've seen today.
Well, I am organizing sharps to march on the steps of Washington and chant, take our bets, because, hey, this is my cause. I just think the books take the action. I do not buy this idea that they will try to dig deeper in the pockets of the degenerates, because I see them so aggressively diving in there and getting whatever it is they can get. So much of this. What do you make of what we're seeing right now? These crazy stories where athletes are talking about the level of vitriol that they're getting from people who are angry over losing. I thought it was almost apocryphal when I would hear this stuff, but now I'm seeing specifics. Bickerstaff, the coach of the Cavs, talking about people getting his number and threatening him. Halliburton talking about how he's seen as a prop. This is an ugly side of it that I think was less anticipated. What do you make of that aspect of it?
I think it's become increasingly concerning how numb people get to these issues so quickly, right? And what I mean by that is, if you think about the major sports gambling scandals of the past, we still talk about that, right? We still talk about Pete Rose. We talk about all those scandals. There was one in college baseball, I think it was last year. Everyone forgot about it, right?
Yes.
There's been a number of them since, and everyone's forgotten about them. This Ohtani thing, I think, is a massive deal. Ooh. And my guess is most people, maybe outside of you and some others, probably won't be talking about it a month or two from now. I think Major League Baseball is quite frankly going to just say, they've already said they're not going to investigate it, which is, you know, when you have $4.5 million leaving an MLB player's bank account and going to a bookie, that seems like the perfect example of something you should probably investigate. So I just think we've become numb to these issues because they become so common. And I think that's kind of a scary place to be.
Well, this is something that I said today, which is that I was writing it going, yeah, they'll probably bury this. This will probably, you know, this will probably be wiped away. The incentives are aligned unless he was betting on baseball games. And then I paused and I thought about it. And I thought about whether he was doing a Pete Rose thing, what it would mean, and if it would matter. And I realized something, which is that it wouldn't matter that much to people. I mean, it would be a big news story. Baseball would have to punish him. But when you look at the media of the late 1980s and how people would be comfortably moralistic about a thing like this, I don't think that would be the tenor, especially not with gambling money soaking through everything currently in sports media. That wasn't the case back then. I think Ohtani would be punished and people would make a bunch of jokes about if he was betting for the Angels, that would be funny. If he was betting against the Angels, that would be funny. And we would just all move on because they need to have Ohtani back. And I don't know how to feel about that. It just appears like we're inviting something, that some sort of guardrail has been taken away and we're in this uncharted territory. And we know that this is the beginning of something, I guess is what I'm saying, Joe. And I'm not sure what to expect going forward other than more Shohei Ohtani's.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that he's probably the first in a long list of professional. He's not even the first, right? We've seen this in the NFL and other leagues.
Calvin Ridley.
Yeah, Calvin Ridley, but other people too. And I think that it's going to become increasingly more often. I think not only athletes betting and getting in trouble, but also people trying to influence the outcome of games because of this. Again, the amount of people that have started to bet on sports versus what was pre-2018, you know, it's a multiple of that by several. And the problem that invites is now there's way more incentive to start messing with the outcome of these games, because before it was a small subset of people, maybe not even sports fans, who were legally or illegally betting on games and were putting large sums of money. Now, most of the bettors today that have entered the market since 2018 are what we'll call like retail bettors, right? They're not betting huge sums of money. But now the quantity of people who have the desire or the incentive to change the outcome of games based on what they're betting has multiplied. And I think that's why going into the future, again, we just talked about this, there's going to be more scandals, and there already have. Everyone forgot about what happened in college baseball last year. Who was the team? Was it Temple this year? There was another basketball team that one of the lines changed at the last minute. No one was hurt. You know, it got flagged by a bunch of the betting companies. So there's a bunch of different things going on. And I think to your point, it's probably only going to become more apparent. And I think the Shohei Ohtani situation is specifically interesting because there's like some pretty obvious red flags here. And it feels like Major League Baseball is looking at what's happened over the last couple of decades with their game, seeing how big Ohtani is as a star, and has maybe chosen like, hey, he said he just paid off his friend's debt or the money was stolen, like done. And look, I don't think there's a lot of, you know, theories out there that Ohtani was betting on games and doing whatever. The most likely outcome, in my opinion, at least based on what we know so far, is that his friend bet a bunch of money. The bookies knew that Ohtani would be able to cover it if he needed to, because let's be honest, there's not a bookie in the world that would give you a $4.5 million line of credit if you had a $300,000 salary, right? Like that just wouldn't happen. So whether it was explicitly said or they knew that Ohtani would cover it, there was some kind of understanding that the bets would be covered. So
I don't know. I just want to interject. I don't know how you bet, but a lot of times my friends and I will go in on something together. I mean, I feel like that's something that's quite possible in a situation like this too, where it's easy to say, oh, it was him. But you know, it seems like those are conversations that happen. And I mean, I don't necessarily think it was just this guy making a six-figure income running up a tab in the millions, but you were saying.
Yeah, no, that's basically what I was saying, right? It's just the idea that they're best friends, right? They spend a whole hell of a lot of time together. He didn't have the income to be able to substantiate these bets. It made no sense from an income perspective. And now you have Ohtani, who allegedly sent the money. And I think the most interesting part about this story, and quite frankly, why I don't believe it, is that his team initially said Ohtani sent the money. They offered up the interpreter as an interview for 90 minutes with ESPN. The interpreter essentially confirmed exactly what their team had said, that Ohtani sent the money. And then they came back later, after, I assume, realizing that it's a federal crime to, or potentially a crime to wire money in an illegal booking scheme, and said, no, that's actually not what happened. He stole the money. So I think one of the things that we have to look out for here is what ends up happening to the interpreter. If they don't press charges, they don't go after him legally, then there's probably a pretty good sign that this was a friend saying, you know, hey, we fucked up. I'm going to take the fall for you on this rather than letting you with the $700 million contract do that.
Yeah, I wrote today that if Ohtani did it, which I mean, I mean that's what I think. If I have to think something,
placed all the bets himself, or was like basically they were betting on things together. He covered the tab.
Yeah, basically. I mean, I don't know if they were betting on things together. I don't know if maybe he was betting singularly, but these were bets that were placed out of his account. So, for instance, even if the original story was true, the story that's been changed where he was just covering the tab, if it's coming out of your account, it's kind of like in The Departed, where if a gun is pointed at you, whether it's a cop or a criminal, what's the difference? I mean, it's coming out of your bank account. So I don't know if I care if this was something that your friend wanted to do versus yourself. And now there's this other story about the I think that's exactly why
they changed the story, right? Was because
it doesn't matter.
I mean, his interpreter said, I think the quote was like, I was standing over his shoulder or something and he sent the money, which is, you know, that's just as bad as it gets. And then when they saw that quote, they were like, no, that's total bullshit. And it was like, well, you guys just told us that was true yesterday. So I think that's probably why they changed their story.
Yeah. Well, something I said today is that if he did knowingly break these rules, I have some sympathy in the sense that, I mean, could you imagine coming over from Japan? And you're seeing sports gambling advertised everywhere. And in most states you're traveling to, it's totally legal to make, you know, to place a sports bet. And you come from very orderly northern Japan. You're in LA, where let's just say rules on the street are not aggressively enforced. It seems like people can maybe just do drugs on the sidewalk. And you're supposed to know that when it's being advertised everywhere, sports gambling, that it's wrong and you can get dinged and you can, you know, potentially go to jail for making a bet when during these games, they're just inundated with advertisements saying it's totally cool and it's a hobby to make a bet. I feel like this would be etiquette that would be difficult to grasp for somebody from outside the United States who is perceiving a situation where our laws are not necessarily enforced on the ground, that this would be any sort of issue. And frankly, it's hard to even articulate why California has gambling still illegal versus the three bordering states where it's legal. I just think this is an aspect that hasn't really been discussed, which is that this would be all very confusing to an outsider.
Yeah, I agree with Ohtani potentially getting confused, right? Like you just said, I mean, you can buy weed on the corner in LA. The idea that he knows the difference between seeing a sportsbook advertisement in Boston when they play the Red Sox versus at home is totally understandable, considering he's only lived here for a number of years. The thing that I think a lot of people were confused on, and I tweeted out, was the idea that his interpreter said in the article that he thought it was the same as DraftKings. This guy, most people assume, came with Ohtani because that was the story. What people don't know is that he moved to LA when he was 7 years old. He's lived in LA his entire life, middle school, high school, college. He then moved to Boston to work for the Red Sox right out of school. And then he moved to Japan to interpret for the team that Ohtani was playing for in, I think, 2013. And then he moved back to the U.S. in 2017. So he was only out of the country for 4 years of his adult life so far. I find it hard to believe that, you know, and don't get me wrong, some bookies have very sophisticated systems where they can, you know, you log onto an app, it looks legit in some way, but you're not betting $4.5 million on credit with DraftKings. So I think that the idea that he had no idea is probably a little misjointed. Yeah. Maybe Ohtani could get confused, but I think that, his interpreter.
I don't even think it's about confused, Joe. I think it's just perceiving a situation where we don't seem to regard this with much seriousness.
Yeah.
And have no moralism surrounding it, but have these almost vestigial rules in certain states. I mean, I've looked it up. Japan is not a place where one prefecture to the next, is that how you pronounce it? I don't know. But like one region to the next in Japan, there it doesn't have this American system where there are dramatically different laws, right? They don't have 50 states that are all performing their little experiment in this republic. That's not how things work. I think it would just be very strange. It would be very odd, this notion that what seems to have been nationally accepted in this specific place you're at is going to be. And frankly, I'm surprised it was. I mean, I'll say that much. I'm surprised that the FBI even cares at this point.
Do you think that if it comes out that it was Ohtani betting on games, right? But he didn't bet on baseball. He bet on international soccer, like they say, NFL, NBA, college football. Do you think he should get in trouble with baseball?
With baseball, I'm a big believer in allowing the criminal justice system to do its thing. And I think that the leagues have gotten overly involved in submitting punishments, especially before the criminal justice system renders its verdict. I need to maybe know a little more details about what he did, the level of illegality, but I don't think so. I don't think so. If he's betting on soccer, in theory, he's allowed to do that. I don't think he's allowed to make illegal bets on it, but I think he's allowed to make legal bets on soccer.
This is where I'm going with it, though, right? Is I think that a lot of people are you know, paying attention to this because it's Ohtani. He's a big name. It's in a sport that's on the decline. He's global. And it's sports betting. It's kind of sexy to some degree, right? Like everyone's, you know, wires are being moved around. It's his interpreter. He got fired. Who's lying? So I totally get why people are interested. But I think if we boiled it down to just that, which is, okay, Ohtani bet on games. He lost $4.5 million, but he never bet on baseball, never bet for his team against his team. I think most people would probably say that that's okay, right? Baseball players can bet on games. They have to do it through legal sports books, of course. But if you look at what's happened criminally, I don't really know of any big criminal cases where someone who was just betting was charged with a crime for wiring the money, right? So it's a crime. Don't get me wrong. I think it's punishable up to 2 years in jail time. You can get a hefty fine, but that's usually not prosecuted. So on a legal side, my guess is he probably wouldn't be. And I think baseball has shown in the past that you can bet on games that aren't baseball. And I think there was even a player, I could be wrong on this, but I think he played for the Marlins that MLB made pay a fine for wiring money to an illegal bookmaker. So that would set a precedence where it's like, okay, this is kind of going to get wiped under the rug and no one's going to care.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be hard to even articulate why this is bad, right? Where it's bad that you did it illegally, which hurts so many people versus doing it through legal means. I mean, how, for what, for why? I think it's all just a matter of being above board and letting Uncle Sam get a taste of it.
But I don't think the average person cares about that, right? I don't think the average person cares if he did it with DraftKings or an illegal bookmaker.
I think people would love it if Ohtani joined Barstool or Bill Simmons podcast and did a guess the lines through the interpreter for soccer. I think that'd be something that people would be into and they would enjoy that kind of thing. I think I would enjoy that kind of thing. I want to know more about the interpreter. I mean, this guy who raised in America and it seems like he would have tremendous insights into Ohtani, who is still this mystery figure, but for this right now. But here's the issue. Here's the big problem as I see it, at least in terms of the athletes. This Ohtani scandal, I don't believe, is going to rise to the level of an enduring scandal, but it is a canary in the coal mine because red flags, a lot of red flags. What you're seeing is the potential for an athlete to lose a lot of money very quickly. You know, we can debate whether or not that's exactly what happened here, but I think it's an illustration of what can happen and what I do believe is happening, which is that some of these guys with their competitive nature and that they're young and they've got a lot of money in their pocket and they're chasing the dragon of this competition, they lose a lot of money very quickly. And that's when you get into this territory of
what I call... I was just going to say, in a lot of cases, they think they know more than other people because of their status in the sport that they play in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Anybody watching the sports studio shows or listening to athletes on sports talk radio has seen a little bit of that. So they get in over their skis and suddenly they've been delivered this humiliating blow of losing all their money. And now they're in a circumstance where they need to make the money back. And unlike most people, when they lose all the money, well, I mean, I'm into this idea of the fraud triangle, though I can never quite remember all the elements of it. But I think it has something to do with pressure, opportunity, rationalization. That's something like what they call the fraud triangle. Well, you've got the pressure of losing your money. You've got the opportunity of being in sports and having inside information. And then however you want to rationalize it, I think that's the easiest part. It just seems like we are laying the groundwork for Tim Donaghy situations on the athlete side. And I mean, when it starts happening and it starts happening frequently, you can't say we didn't know. You can't say there were no signs. To me, it almost seems like a fait accompli, Joe. What do you think?
Wouldn't you think that's an argument for legalization, though? Because, and I'll tell, and the reason I ask that is because
I'm open to this. Let's hear it.
Because the fraud triangle that you described, that can really only occur in an underground world, right? In a legal world. The idea that if you set up an account, I mean, you can have a friend set it up, whatever. So there's other ways to get around it. But let's just talk about you setting up an account as an athlete and betting on games. Again, you can bet on games in certain leagues that are not associated with your league. So it's a little bit easier to track these things if you're legalized. Now, I don't necessarily believe that myself, but I think that would be the argument for legalization.
Yeah, it gets a little interesting with Ohtani, though, because this is an aspect I haven't explored at all. But when if Ohtani ever got into big trouble and he just went back to Japan? I mean, I don't know. Or it gets a little bit fuzzy with the role of international players. I think it is an argument for it. I think in theory you could aggressively kind of create some sort of, as they say, Chinese wall between the playing of sports and the betting on sports.
How would you do that?
I mean, obviously in your own sport that already exists, but you would have to be very aggressive with it where guys are banned for life. And they're not willing to do that with Ohtani. So that's one that they're just going to have to, you know, even if he's bet on baseball, maybe they just have to kind of take that one in the ribs, as it were, or wear it, as they say in baseball. But eventually, I think that might be the only way to really do it, is to have incredibly harsh punishments and try to kind of construct a new morality where somehow there are sports gambling advertisements everywhere, but the players get a signal that this is the line that you do not cross. Because right now, it just seems very loosey-goosey and glib. And there are plenty of opportunities. I mean, here's another thing. Maybe this is too much of a digression, but I really want your thoughts on it, because you do a lot of content on the NBA and the business of the NBA. I've written about how the NBA changed its interpretations of the rules. You did some content right before they did it about the scoring binge and just how much teams were scoring and the issue it presented to the NBA. They sneakily, in the shadows, directed the refs to start calling things differently. I know they have a different interpretation, whatever. I mean, the data is just incontrovertible at this point. And you look at a situation like that and you go, man, I mean, if you knew people involved in this decision-making, you could have made a killing. If you were friends with Joe Dumars, for instance, you could have really cashed in. What did you make of that situation? Are there any implications there that are perhaps unsavory, or is it much ado about nothing?
I mean, I think being a lack of transparency is obviously not ideal for fans of the sport, players of the sport, or anything else in between. So I don't necessarily like that. I understand why they did it. I think that the scoring, as I mentioned, some of the things that I had written had gotten out of control. And I think it was to the detriment of viewership and fans of the NBA. I think people have been frustrated with how bad scoring's got, not really just this year, but over the past decade, it's really changed a lot. You can say that it's because how they call fouls. You can talk about how guys are just more skilled now. But it doesn't really matter. The numbers are the numbers, and more points are being scored than ever before. So I understand why they did it. Specifically looking into the future, the media market today, right? If you just look at the media market, what people are spending is extremely dry relative to what we've seen over the last decade plus. That's only going to get worse into the future. And I think the NBA is trying to figure
let's get some, I want some more of that.
Yeah.
Can you make that case to people? Because I don't think everybody knows that. You know, what are the examples recently where this bonanza of TV rights that we've been living through, what is the dryness that you're seeing?
So there's less bids for each rights that go up, mostly. But then you can look at the actual percentage increase, right? So I forget the exact numbers, but basically if you compare the current college football playoff media rights deal, which, let's be fair and honest, is probably the second biggest sport in the U.S., to the NFL, then college football, then I would rank the NBA.
Definitely.
That's the second biggest sport. The ESPN bought it for a tremendous sum of money, but on a percentage increase relative to the previous deal, it was less of an increase despite the field being expanded to 12 teams, right? So there's more inventory, but on a percentage basis, it went up less than it had previously. So I think we're seeing a little bit of softness there. And what I've seen, what I've heard at least from a bunch of executives and other people in the space, the dream has always been that as cable continues to decline, they're going to transition people to digital. And then these big tech media companies are going to come in and save everyone because they have more money than they know what to do with. And that eventually is going to add more bidders and just supply and demand is going to take over and rights are going to continue to go up. Now, I do think that's going to happen over the next few years. ESPN has obviously invested a tremendous amount of money in premium sports rights, knowing that they're eventually going to try to transition everyone to digital. They think content is king. Let's get the best rights we can. But what I don't know is going to happen is that as the economics change for a lot of the traditional cable companies, I don't think they're going to be able to afford more expensive rights as they keep going up. And I really don't know what the appetite is from all of the streamers yet either, right? If you think about the streaming companies, a lot of them have really just kind of picked at the side so far. Apple's a good example. Apple has a tremendous amount of money. They did the MLS package, but they want to own entire leagues. The NBA is probably not going to do that. The NFL is not going to do that. College football can't do that. So their strategy is fundamentally different than some other ones. They bought, you know, individual games. Amazon did the Thursday Night Football package, but no one has really gone all in yet. And again, maybe that will change over the next 5 or 6 years. But I have a hard time believing that we're going to continue to see this dramatic rise in broadcasting fees like we've done. And I mean, you probably saw this. Mark Cuban literally said it out loud during that interview. He said, I'm not worried about this media rights deal. I'm worried about the next one. And part of that is local broadcasting rights, but a huge chunk of this is national broadcasting rights as well.
Yeah. And that, I mean, prompts the question of Cuban, then, well, why didn't you get out after this media rights deal? You know, if, like, the big concern of yours is the next one. It seems like you had a lot of time to get out potentially. And now he still has a significant chunk of the Mavericks, but that is quite curious. And it's one of the many signals. I mean, there's almost this cognitive dissonance. I'm trying to figure out what to make of the NBA rights situation, because it appears that there are these signals, these revealed preferences that are running counter to the narratives that I'm reading. When I look at the trades, when I look at the publications like Sports Business Journal, it's just a fait accompli that the NBA is going to sign some lucrative deal with ESPN and TNT and Amazon. Daddy Warbucks Bezos is just going to make them richer than God. And all these issues of them losing audience share, whatever. The streamers are coming in. The NBA is hot. So I see that. But I see what you're talking about, which is that college football is so hot right now. Sound like I'm at a Zoolander when I say that. But it's so hot right now, and they didn't get the big bump. And that's very curious, okay? Yeah. Mark Cuban, the most famous NBA owner, as you mentioned right now, sold his team. That's curious. The NBA, in secret, changing their rules mid-season, after having these talks at All-Star break with the broadcasters. Maybe that's a coincidental connection. Well, maybe not.
The other thing I would say,
curious.
It's very curious. And the other thing I would say on that, which I know you've talked about and a few other people I've seen talk about it as well, but I don't think it can be under discussed, which is how these metrics have changed over how Nielsen calculates TV viewership, right?
Yes, the great
many people that don't do this for a living, right? Don't write about sports media or anything like that. They don't understand how these are calculated. And I don't blame them for that. It's kind of done in secrecy a lot of the time. But it's changed over the years, and they've added out-of-home viewership. And that's why you've seen these numbers. It feels like everything in sports is a record today, from the NFL and everything else. But I would caveat that with the NBA doesn't feel as hot as maybe those leagues do with the records that we've seen, right? We saw with the Super Bowl, the AFC Championship, the NFC Championship, Wild Card. I mean, Peacock had 23 million viewers for a Wild Card game. I tweeted about it today. They got 3 million subscribers, and 70% of them are still subscribed months later. That's a tremendous outcome. And it only, I mean, we already saw they paid, I think it was $110 million for that game. Amazon's now paying $150 million for the same game next year. Like, that is the stuff that people are going to go pay for. It's all going to aggregate towards the best and the most premium rights, because that's going to move the needle over something like, I would argue, Christmas Day in the NBA, which used to be the premier event. And now the NFL has tried to encroach on that a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is definitely my wheelhouse. Maybe I'm going to start scooping myself over topics. I prefer talking about the TV rating situation with the NBA to writing about it, because there's a level of defensiveness in NBA media and from some fans on this issue that is tiresome to just confront. And I don't want to let them control what I do, but there is this aspect where when you talk about it, people start rolling their eyes and they groan and they get very angry at you for pointing these things out. While at the same time, it is utterly dictating so many high-level decisions that the league has, and they're creating stuff like the in-season tournament. And like I said, changing the rules because of this. Obviously, it matters. Now, to what you were saying, everybody's gotten this big boost from out-of-home, this double-digit boost where suddenly they count not just the TV watching inside the home, but everywhere else. And it doesn't even make sense, because even though people are watching less TV than ever, there are records being set all over the place because they've juiced the numbers, right?
Which I would argue is not a bad thing, right? Because it's more accurate. It should be, at least.
Yeah, it just provides an illusion of growth. It's like more accurate as a measure of just counting everybody. But since we just started doing it, it makes it look like it just jumped up when it didn't jump up, but it didn't jump up for the NBA. The NBA,
which would mean that it's actually down.
Yes. I just looked at the numbers, scooping myself over here. This is also the reason, Joe, why I think I have a bit of a market on this. I don't want to be Mr. NBA hater, but it's almost like it's getting graded on this insane curve, so I look, you know, like a hater if I talk about it. It has fallen by the wayside that this is going to be a record for the least watched NBA season on broadcast TV ever, after they juice the numbers. Worse than the pandemic, the lowest ratings ever on ABC. It is going to be down this season on TNT versus last season. ESPN looks like it might be even probably going to be down versus last season. So it's gone the wrong direction. And I caught a lot of shit for saying that the in-season tournament was a ratings flop. I think that this is something that I have been validated on. Again, hating. It's hard to be right about negative things. Like when you say a player's going to get injured, you know, you never want to take that victory lap. But I mean, look, they tried to goose it. They added all these bells and whistles. They spent a ton of money promoting the in-season tournament. And now we look back on the regular season ratings and they are down. Again, it's another signal where maybe the trades are correct. Maybe the industry publications are correct and it's all sunshine and rainbows. I don't know, but I think that's why you're seeing some of these panicky decisions, because it just seems like Adam Silver is just trying everything he can and throwing everything at the wall. And at least in the short term, they are really struggling. They're just really struggling to make these games matter to people.
Yeah, there's a couple things off of that. Number one, I think it's important to remember how money has changed over the last decade since that first deal was announced, right? Inflation has obviously been tremendous over the last few years. And if you look at like NASCAR is a good example, many people probably have no idea how much NASCAR gets from their media rights package. But if you look at the previous deal versus their new deal, it's essentially flat, if not down, on an inflation adjusted basis. So that obviously plays a huge part of this. I do think that the NBA is going to see an increase. It'll probably be somewhere between, you know, 2x, around 2x what they get now, is my opinion. But when this conversation started, it was like 3 to 4x we were going to see. Yeah. So everyone's kind of tempered their expectations a little bit, which I think is fair. And the NBA will still go out and celebrate it as a huge win because they're doubling their media rights, which is great, right? But I think that the part that you're discussing a little bit too with the in-season tournament is I always caution people to just like do just one more level of research into what is being reported, right? And this is part of the reason why I love, absolutely love writing my own newsletter, doing my own podcast, creating my own content, is because in a lot of places, you're not able to do this. And I'm sure you know this as well. It's like, if you start to question some of these things, you get looked at as a hater. And I don't see myself as that. Most times, I think I'm an optimist in most situations. But what happens with specifically the season tournament, if I remember correctly, was if you went and examined the exact games that they were comparing the ratings to, they weren't apples to apples, right? It was like, you know, a Tuesday night game between two bottom of the league teams versus an in-season tournament game between two of the best teams in the league. Like, obviously that would get a better rating, whether it was at the in-season tournament or a regular season game. It doesn't really matter. So I think the context of it was a little bit misleading. And that's ultimately why many people probably don't trust these numbers as much as they might have in the past.
Yeah, I think people just don't know. I think we're just... When it comes to the NBA, they are very aggressive about their PR beyond what the other leagues are. And many people don't know how to look at the numbers to what you're saying. They don't know what out of home is. They don't have the context. When I say people, I'm not even talking about fans. I'm talking about people in media.
Yeah.
And they're not incentivized to. You know, they're not incentivized to get called, get a call from Michael Bass at the Olympic Tower working for the NBA and get yelled at. That's not something that they really, it's just easier not to. But it's interesting to watch this happen year after year, and then they don't take a step back and they don't go, what the hell happened here? Why have we lost so much traction? Why are we so much less popular relative to the NFL? Yeah, it's easy to say NFL is king, but as you've pointed out, when you look at the top 100 sports events of the year, the NBA, I think in 2017, was 17 of those, and now they're none of them. So they've lost relative traction. They were ahead of the World Series. Now they're the same as the World Series. And baseball, theoretically, from the same people who will boost the NBA, is dying. So what the hell does that mean about the NBA? I'm not trying to be a doomer. I love basketball. I love the NBA. I just look at it as something that is being mismanaged as a product. I think it's the greatest game in the world, but it's not being handled in such a way as to help it flourish. And at a certain point, it would be nice to see more people within that ecosystem, within that industry going, what's going on here? When we take a step back, yeah, you're telling me that things are up versus last year or giving me some misleading context. But when we look and take a step back, we see an incredible erosion. How do we reverse that? I just wish more of those conversations were happening.
They would be helpful. That's for certain. But I think off of that, one of the more interesting things that I've noticed in sports, and maybe this has changed a little bit over the last year or two, but is just the opinion of Adam Silver in this conversation, right? Like I wrote about this previously. And when it comes to commissioners in sports, any commissioner you think of, they're almost like universally hated by the fans, right? Like Roger Goodell, the fans hate him. Owners love the commissioners because their sole job is they work for the owners and it's to maximize value via media rights and franchise valuations and other things like that. I think Adam Silver for a long period of time, and again, maybe this has changed since then, but he was loved by pretty much everyone. Everyone said that he was doing a great job. And part of this was because of what he's done from a player empowerment standpoint of giving players power to move teams and demand more money and do these things. He did a lot of things on the social justice front, which I think a lot of people maybe appreciated on that side of the aisle as well. And from an ownership perspective, even though they probably didn't like some of these things that he was doing for players, everything was going up and to the right, so it didn't really matter. And I think what we're going to find is that as that narrative shifts over the coming years a little bit, that relationship with the media, but also fans and the players, is going to change for him.
I think It might, unless he pulls a Mark Cuban and gets out of Dodge before it's an issue. If he signs, seals, and delivers a great TV rights deal, he can parachute out before shit hits the fan. I think I'm mixing my metaphors right here.
That's what someone told me about. Someone tweeted me yesterday, and they said that about the sports betting thing. They said that's the next CEO's problem. My problem right now is to increase revenue.
Yeah. You kick it down the road. Yeah. But it is, I do think you're identifying a real dynamic where he's so pro player that it might be to the detriment of the sport sometimes. I'm just picturing him if he was in charge of baseball and Otani was in a scandal. It was like, I talked to Otani, and he's very sorry that he placed bets. We don't like that, and we would like to reduce that behavior. And he promised not to do it again.
Was that specifically from his comments on Draymond Green? Because that sounded awfully familiar. Yeah, that sounded
all these guys.
Familiar.
You know,
that was amazing.
I talked to Ja. I told him to put the gun away wasn't necessary for a conversation, and he was very apologetic.
This is amazing.
I mean, it's
true, though.
Hey,
that's why it's
funny. He's the player's commish. What can you say? This is great. We'd love to have you back. I love talking about this stuff. Obviously, we've got a lot of overlap. Joe, do you have anything in addition to what we talked about at the beginning? We've already promoted you at the beginning, but let's give you an opportunity to promote yourself again on the outro. Where should we check you out?
I appreciate it. I had a bunch of fun. I'd love to do it again. I write a Substack, readhuddleup.com. You can check it out. I have a podcast, The Joe Pomp Show, and Twitter is the biggest platform. I'm everywhere at Joe Pompliano, but Twitter specifically is the biggest one.
Yeah, you're going to have to tell me how to get good on Twitter. I paid Elon for the super premium, expecting some sort of boost, and no, just as bad as usual. Some people lose all their money to the books. I lose all my money to Elon Musk and get nothing in return. That's what's going on for me. But maybe I can pick up a tip or two from you. And hey, maybe next time I won't interject and expound as much as I did. It's your fault for talking about so many things that I'm wholly interested and immersed in. So thank you so much, Joe. Look forward to checking out the content.
Thanks, Ethan.